and welcome to the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zellman, and with me today is Scott Gell of the Filament Group. He is a web designer and developer who works with the bright folks at Filament Group, creating websites and applications for a broad range of clients, including the 2012 Responsive Design of the Boston Globe. He's a huge contributor to the open source community, frequently releasing ideas and projects on GitHub. A jQuery team member, most recently leading the development of jQuery Mobile, and the co-author of Designing with Progressive Enhancement, New Riders. And we're here to talk about PictureFill, a responsive images polyfill approach that web designers and developers can use today. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Jeffrey. How's it going?
Great. Thanks for joining us. Are you in Cambridge?
Well, I used to be. I'm in Florida these days.
Florida. So you work remotely?
Yes. Yeah. I dial in remotely with the folks in Boston. Actually, quite a few of us at Filament are remote now.
That's a very huge change.
It was. Yeah. It started with, I actually took a kind of a trip for 8 months or so abroad in Asia. And that was sort of our first foray into having one employee that was remote. And, it took some getting used to.
What was
with that time change?
What was remote working from Asia like in terms of bandwidth, network reliability, that kind of thing?
Man, it sure reminded me that the web is not the same web for everyone. It was pretty frustrating at times, and sometimes it was a lot better, a lot faster than we have here. So it really varied. You know, in the cities, it tended to be a little ahead of the times compared to here in the States. So,
what do you mean?
Speeds connecting to the cell networks and on Wi-Fi networks. Everything just seemed to be, I don't know, maybe newer, more modern. I don't know if we're running on older wires here.
Well, in places, I remember in Turkey, I went there in 1999, and everyone had what they called a handy. Right, which was a mobile phone with some internet features. Mm-hmm. In 1999, when I didn't know anybody in America that did. I mean,
the early days for that stuff.
But they didn't have lots of landlines. Countries where they didn't do a lot of 20th century technological infrastructure tended to have more 21st century technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. This is why, like, there's villages, right, where they have a wireless network but no flush toilets.
Right, right. Yeah, certainly an interesting situation. So it taught me a lot, for sure. I mean, I think it's good to get out of the comfort zone now and then and realize that we're building for a lot broader audience than just people like us.
Well, does PictureFill... And does the picture element and the whole notion of responsive images, it seems like a double-edged sword as far as that goes, in that, if you can look for screen size and serve people smaller images that are appropriate to their screen, conserving their bandwidth that way, but isn't the picture element and picture fill and responsive images also about... sending retina images when appropriate and things like that.
So that makes it tricky.
You may be sending a 10 megabyte image.
Yeah, you could be. And that's, I think that's, the real value in a native implementation, which, is on the way in Chrome, and really every major browser is working on it now. Pretty exciting.
Right now there's a picture element being supported in Chrome, Opera, because it's really the same, and Firefox.
I don't know if any of them have landed it in their stable version yet. No. But they're all right. They're all underway.
But have we heard anything from IE or Safari?
I think I may be a few days behind on this, but the last I heard about the IE team, they have this status page that they post all of their feature statuses and where they are on implementation, and picture is listed on there. So that was kind of a major step, I think, for for seeing that it's actually on their radar, and it was pretty high up in the list too. So that was nice to see.
Status.modern.ie.
Yeah, I think that's it. Right. But I beyond that, I haven't seen any word, you know, official word from the development team on what they're doing with it.
And Apple never tells anybody anything.
Right. But a WebKit implementation is underway. The same. Yeah, the same person who did a little crowdfunding campaign to get the Blink or Chrome implementation going just hit like a secondary goal, 15,000 to fund the WebKit version too. So
I'm sorry, an individual did crowdfunding to get money for Chrome, a Google product, to support Picture, a web standard. I just want to make sure that I understood what you said. A private individual raised money from other private individuals to get a pittance, $10,000 a pittance in Google's terms, so that Google would consider implementing a W3C standard, the Picture element.
Yeah, well,
is that how we're going to do web standards now? We like,
it's certainly it's a first, right?
I mean, in a way, like, God bless that hero. And in another way, wow, really? That's what it takes?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, actually, Google contributed a little money too, just as much as, you know, a lot of other orgs.
They contributed money to their own salaries. Really? That's so nice of them.
Yeah. I think there's an upside here too, because the person who's doing the implementation, Yoav Weiss, I think I pronounced his name right, and maybe Yoav, I'm not sure. He's kind of been heading the whole responsive images community group along with Matt Markey over at Filament Group.
Right.
And so we have someone who's, you know, who's deeply, you know, informed on the spec and actually working on the spec actively, you know, working on the implementation too, which is nice because all the people in this community who are working on this project actually, you know, have direct input to the person who's implementing it. Whereas maybe it would be a little, you know, harder to reach the people who are building it. So, I mean, you know, upsides and downsides. I think that is a common question, though. You know, why couldn't Google just, you know, build this themselves? But I think this also puts it high on the priority list, whereas it may have been a little lower for Google with all the other things they're working on.
So. True. But, and then Opera is sort of going to get it because they're still in the same fork as Chrome.
Yeah, that's my understanding. As soon as it's built for Blink, it's built for Opera and Chrome.
And Firefox is just, they didn't do a Kickstarter for Firefox?
As far as I know, they were planning on
doing it anyway.
Yeah, on their own roadmap. So,
because they like it because it's a non-patent encumbered open standard.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, this is something we've all needed for quite a while, especially users needed. So
for people who are unfamiliar with, I mean, there's lots of great articles about the Picture element, and they will all be on our show page, folks. I've taken the liberty of creating finding articles by you and Matt Marquis and Ethan Marcotte and Dave Rupert. Just lots of background stuff about what all this is. But I've actually seen you give a great presentation about designing responsibly and responsively. And I know you're working on writing about that, I believe.
Yeah.
Without
absolutely
getting into details. And where does Picture fill? Obviously, we hope to just have Picture element one day. So Picture fill, for people who aren't familiar, okay, let's back up. When there's a standard or a potential standard and browsers don't support it yet, Picture, then a polyfill is a way of using JavaScript to emulate that, to emulate support for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's sort of two different levels here, right? There's a shim and a polyfill.
Okay. I've never understood the difference.
Okay, yeah, well, I mean, they're both kind of just casual terms anyway. I don't know if they're properly defined, but to me anyway, a shim is something that is sort of a quick and dirty workaround that happens to enable a feature. Like a good example would be the HTML5 shiv or shim, which just happens to make IE support styling of new HTML elements just by running this little JavaScript line called create element. So it was discovered accidentally, you know. And you don't really have to do anything to beyond that to make the feature work. It's just sort of, you know, this one-liner that you can do to all these new elements. Whereas a polyfill is much fuller implementation. You're trying to reproduce a whole API in JavaScript and in the DOM and HTML. So it's, you know, it's a lot of code compared to a shim.
That makes perfect sense. And even the words, actually, now that you've said that, it makes sense. Shim, almost like when the table's uneven, so the waiter puts a sugar packet under the table, just a little nothing. Like, this line of code may help, as opposed to, here's an API. So how do you think about, how does picture element help you design responsibly?
Okay. So we have this problem right now where we're trying to support a wide array of screen sizes with a single adapting design, right? A responsive layout. And usually the images that we drop into those, if they need to work at all breakpoints, then we have to go with the largest size and shrink it down. Let the browser scale it down when it's shown on a smaller screen. And that means that makes for a lot of overhead. So you're sending potentially very large images over the network and only using a fraction of the kilobyte size that you actually sent.
So in the past, right, mm-hmm. if this wasn't in HTML, and you wanted to, in the past you might have done window detection and then served one of us, you know, you would have done it all on the server side and maybe just use JavaScript for sniffing. But this all moves this is not a REST treatment, or is it? This moves everything into JavaScript, correct?
Right. And eventually it'll need no JavaScript at all.
Right. It'll just be the picture element, which says in this, you know, if this configuration serve this image, if that configuration serve that image. How about with art direction? Aren't there art directional applications for this as well?
Yeah. So I guess just to kind of back up and give an explanation of the difference. So we have kind of two aspects to the picture element that are coming in. There's the element itself, picture, which is a wrapper for an image now. So it used to be sort of this media component of its own. But recent changes in the spec have made it so that the picture element is just sort of a container for an image tag. And it acts as a controller for the eventual source that'll be assigned to that image. So you kind of give all these source elements in that picture tag followed by an image, and all of those sources are used to evaluate what the best possible source is to set on that image in the end. So this is different than the first iterations of when we were trying to figure out what the picture element should work like.
When it was more like the video element.
Yeah, exactly. And the image, if there was one inside it, was just a fallback, right? But now it's actually the element that displays the visuals. So picture is just used to sort of, you know, act as a controller.
So that makes a lot more sense.
It made it easier for them to implement, I think, now, is the big thing.
In terms of progressive enhancement, what happens if if their browser doesn't understand HTML5, in the case of the actual picture element, or in the case of this polyfill, they're, for whatever reason, they don't have JavaScript at this moment, or there's no JavaScript in their device, they're on some crappy kiosk at an airport or something, what will they see instead? Is there like a default small image?
Yeah, so interesting problem there. So the image, so images in the page, along with this new picture element, images themselves, image tags, have new attributes that we can use. And you may or may not need the picture tag at all. If you're not art directing, then all you need is a couple attributes on the image tag, and these are sizes and source set. So those attributes, well, source set is already supported in a couple browsers like Chrome. And source set basically lets you list potential source URLs for the image along with either widths of the image or 1x, 2x, 3x kind of distinctions for basically how high resolution the image is, right? So that really handles the SD HD screen problem very well, right? So that source set attribute is already supported in some places. You can also use source set on the image that's inside a picture tag. And that's where things get sort of tricky, because when we're polyfilling the picture tag right now, we're working against browsers that understand source set in some cases on that inner image, but they don't understand the wrapper picture tag. And we want to be able to use the picture tag. So the problem is when Chrome encounters this picture element with an image in it, it's just going to go out and fetch whatever source it finds on that image tag as soon as it can. And that's actually before we can get to it with JavaScript. So that's a real problem. There's a temporary overhead that we're going to have to endure between now and whenever picture is natively supported in these browsers. But it's kind of like it's a small problem just for a couple browsers like Chrome on the desktop.
It's the original picture poly picture fill was lower in bandwidth, correct?
Yeah. So
why is it work? What's the trade off? What's going on there?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm sorry that this you jump around so much with this story. It's
I'm sorry. Should we tell it a different way? If I'm jerking you around, what?
I meant you as in the royal we.
Okay.
We jump around a lot talking about this, but to sort of ease into it a little more, picture fill has been around a long time, long before the picture element spec was even close to being finalized. So at that time, picture fill didn't try to mimic a new element picture. It just used span elements and attributes, data attributes, to sort of mimic the behavior. And the way it did that was all these spans followed by a NoScript tag with an image in it. And that was sort of like the no JavaScript fallback, right?
Wow.
Like an old school NoScript.
Wow. Tag, now, so right? Now you're talking my language.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's, now you just need low source and
exactly.
We'd really be back in the 90s. Okay.
Right. And then if JavaScript was present, it would actually generate an image and assign it a source based on all the information it found in those spans. So it largely mimicked where we are today with this native element, but it did so using elements that were already standard and not likely to become native one day and be implemented differently than we expected and break everything, right? So it was sort of an unfortunate but responsible way to approach it until we had a spec to work against. So recently that spec was sort of finalized and browsers began implementing the real element. And that's when we decided, okay, it's time to make the polyfill work on the real element itself, because it's on track to become native. So that's where this new problem comes in. We can no longer use the NoScript fallback, because browsers that support picture one day and have JavaScript disabled will show two images. They'll show the picture tag image and the NoScript fallback, right?
Oh.
Which is, right, so that's awful. So anyway, the trade-off we came to is we're just going to, in those cases, fall back to alt text, which is unfortunate. You know, it's I'm not really sure there's a better way, but I also don't like where it is. So so temporarily in
there'll be no image temporarily.
Yeah, there'll be alt text, right? So, and there's really no way we can think of to come up with a fallback.
But you know what? For 20 years, we've been saying alt text was okay for people who couldn't see images. So it's,
Right.
In this weird case where you have a very modern, capable browser, but you've turned JavaScript off, which is like, what is that? Less than 0.1%, less than 0.01%. That's still hundreds of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
But so they'll get some text. They'll get a caption instead of an image.
Yeah.
It's not a terrible experience.
Right.
People have worse web experiences, and it's temporary.
Yeah, it is temporary. It'll go away once it's natively supported. So yeah, if JavaScript's disabled in an existing browser today, or if it's enabled but it somehow fails and we're unable to polyfill the element, like if the JavaScript doesn't load.
Now you say we. Who is we? There's you and there's
on the polyfill end of things.
On the picture. Yeah, on the picture fill. There was another guy who's on GitHub, but doesn't work with you folks, I think.
Yeah. Sean Janzipar.
Yeah. Is that right? That's how you say that?
I think so. I'm reading it phonetically here. Janzipar. Yeah, he's been enormously helpful. He actually kind of kicked off this this new version.
Janzipar on GitHub.com.
Yep. He started the version too.
Do you guys, and he is in Vancouver and you're in Florida.
Yeah, I think so. He's at Mobify, I believe.
He works at Mobify. Okay.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. And they've obviously changed their business model a lot since Responsive came along.
Yeah, I think they have. Yeah.
So how does this work? You and Sean get on Skype or FaceTime or something, or Google Hangout, whatever. Talk about it, and then one of you says, "I'll code this," or how do you divide up the the idea making, the labor? Do you code in parallel and then look at each other? And I mean, how does this work?
Yeah, so this one was kind of interesting. Internally, Matt and I were talking about making this new version.
Matt Marquis, yep. Depending on. Yep. Which side of the Charles River?
Right.
Something crazy like that.
Yeah. So we were talking about, you know, it's the time has come to start working on this new version. And right around that time, Sean on GitHub sent what's called a pull request. Basically, he had written this new version and just sent it over, sent a version of his code over and said, check this out. This is a starting point for the new polyfill. So that was really helpful. And that was the first time we really worked with Sean. He just gave us functional code to work with. So we reviewed that and, you know, it was a really good starting point. It wasn't complete. So we had a few, probably 3 or 4 weeks of work after that in which Sean was collaborating with us and Matt and also John Bender, who works at Filament as well.
How many of you are there now?
There are 8 of us full-time.
All front-end and back-end developers?
And design.
But everyone who designs is also a developer?
We all tend to wear many hats. But I think, you know, we're all specialized in our own areas too. So,
You have you worked on jQuery and jQuery Mobile, and now you're working on this. And Matt obviously was running the RISC, the Responsive Images Consortium community group for the W3C. And how do you guys, you folks, balance? You seem to do a tremendous amount of community projects and open source projects. But you're a small company, and we appreciate it, but you're a small company that also needs to pay the bills and do client work, because after all, this is, in the final analysis, this is all about client work,
right? Yeah.
Being better at client work. So how do you and how does the Filament Group balance company projects versus, the more open source community type projects?
Yeah, good question.
Is it like an 80-20 thing?
Yeah, I think it is. For purely, kind of R&D kind of work, or, you know, picture fill, something like that, is just purely unrelated to our client work. And Patty and Todd at Filament are just sponsoring our time to get it done. So in that way, it's the 80-20 thing. Yeah. But a lot of our open source work is stuff that we're building for client projects that the client has agreed would be, you know, it would be beneficial to have this as an open source component. And it's really interesting how it works.
Has a client ever said, you can do this, but it has to be called Boston Globe Picture Fill or something? Like, you know what I mean?
Have you ever had a client really run into that yet?
Credit?
Yeah, I don't know.
Have you ever had a client say, you know what? I'm paying you. It's work for hire and I own it, so you can't.
Sure. And plenty of the work we do is not open sourced. You know, it's strictly just for their site. But I think we've been, I guess, successful in demonstrating to them the benefits of open sourcing code as we work, because as soon as we put something out there, others in the community are forking it. They're contributing bug fixes. They're finding that it's broken in some version of Android and sending us a fix. And this all gets rolled back into this client work and it costs them nothing. So, I think the benefits there have been very clear to our clients. So, I mean, that's been really great, because that was sort of like a theory that we had before we tried it, that it would really help our client projects, and it worked out. So there was always that worry before we tried it of, you know, ownership, you know, who owns the code, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, licensing and being very clear up front of why it benefits them, the open source parts of their code, and why it makes sense, obviously, to close down the parts that are specific to their business. You know, there's always that divide.
Sure. What about working with other organizations like Google? Right. I know you do a lot of stuff, either working with stuff Paul Irish has created or collaborating with him or mm-hmm. with members of his team. Is it weird or cool to be a design studio working for private clients that also works with these big, powerful browser companies that are the developer relations parts of them?
Hmm. Yeah, I guess it was the picture spec got us into a whole different level of of development than we had been involved with before, you know, even had been comfortable with you know, dealing with before. So yeah, I mean, you know, being able to talk one-on-one with browser developers and actually affect features that are going into browsers was a huge step for us. So yeah, that was really intimidating, I think, at first. But you know, working on the picture element definitely exposed us to a different side of the web development community than we had dealt with in the past. And I think at first it was pretty intimidating, but, you know, very exciting. And I think that this has been a good example of, I think, how much power web developers and authors now have. You know, it's a smaller world, I guess, dealing with browser vendors. It seems like the people working at the browsers are more often actually web developers themselves and understand the challenges that we face. And, you know, it seems like the priorities are lining up more often than not. So
it was very different when I was doing this.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It was a completely secret world. You couldn't mm-hmm. talk to anybody. Opera was nice. They were always pro web standards.
Right.
and we could talk to Hokum, which is amazing, but it didn't necessarily mean you had much say over features. IE was closed mm-hmm. To us for a while, a long while, really. The Mozilla project was open. IE still kind of closed.
Yeah, I mean,
Well, Microsoft and Apple, Microsoft and Apple, just it's a different. It's not because of browsers or that they have some weird attitude toward the web. It's just that's the nature of those companies. They're software, giant software companies.
Yeah. And but I think, you know, the example we talked about earlier with the status page, I mean, there are signs heading in the right direction at IE.
It's weird. I remember when Apple dropped IE5 Mac, right? When they mm-hmm. and came up with a browser and they went to what it was Chrome called before it was called Chrome. When they went to WebKit originally, right? Well, when they went to WebKit originally, it was like, wow, because at the time WebKit wasn't all that compliant. And everyone thought it'll be a Firefox thing. They'll get Mozilla and put it in the Mac, and you know, and we'll be done. They didn't do that, and everyone was shocked. And I thought, oh, they're making some terrible mistake. But of course, they weren't. Mm-hmm. It's just there was a period where WebKit was really open. Where Apple, they had Dave. Wow, what was his name? But the brilliant browser developer, and he was blogging. He was an Apple employee blogging openly about fixing this bug. Well, we've got the ACID 2 test looking really good. We still have a problem with this stuff you would never see from Apple Corporation. And it seemed like, and this was before the iPhone, it seemed like Apple was becoming very open, but that gentleman no longer blogs and all that. That's all been swept away.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember Dave Hyatt.
Dave Hyatt. Yeah, what was the name of his blog?
Surf and Safari.
Oh my God, you are so right. Dave Hyatt, Surf and Safari. Let's see if
that'd be a good. Well, Surf and Safari is still an active blog, I believe.
Is it? Oh, it's the WebKit blog now. You are right.
Yeah, but that would be a good trivia question.
But it's now. It seems like it's more of an informational. It's not as open and here's what we're doing. It's more talking about the internet. It's kind of like a Mozilla developer blog or like a Google page, like the thing Google released the other day, to sort of bring developers up to speed.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems that they're just kind of blogging new features as they land, or you know, some feature doesn't need a prefix anymore, that sort of thing, which you know that's useful too.
The prefix wars. How will we ever tell the kids about the prefix wars?
They will need to.
They will never understand it.
No. Nope. Yeah, that was good riddance.
So I think what you said basically is about balancing. Is it's 80-20. Are there some of your people who do more, like you and Matt, who are more, do more work in the public sphere, and others who are sort of less public and just like hunker down and get the projects done for the client? Or am I?
Yeah, I think so, but it tends to vary depending on interests, really. I mean, none of our job title or descriptions necessarily say that we can or can't work on open source versus client work. It's just sort of, I think it's just based on what we're interested in working on. So pretty fortunate in that regard.
Do you find yourself getting really big projects now?
Yeah, I think ever since the Boston Globe project, the client scene has changed a little bit and it's been interesting. We've had some really, Lego was our biggest client. We just finished the mobile version of the shop.lego.com. And it's responsive. It works.
What do you mean by the mobile version? It's responsive. Don't those?
Yeah. So that's a little so odd. We built, right. So we built a responsive site that, was mobile first and was optimized layout wise up until about a tablet width, and then it just sort of maxes out, right? And the idea was that this would be a good starting point for them to venture into a responsive layout. So they're serving this. They have been serving this responsive site specifically to phones and tablets.
Oh, okay. So it's let's say that it's below a certain breakpoint. Yeah. They switch you over to mobile, and then there are these variously this fluid, responsive layout that adapts well to any
Right. And okay. It works on any, I mean, we tested it.
But on the desktop, but just on my 27-inch monitor, that might be, I might be served a different site for now.
Right. For now. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's a pretty nice.
That's a reasonable way to get into it.
Yeah. Especially with a company like that, where, I mean, changing the Lego shop where they make all of their sales is an enormously risky, you know, decision to make. So being able to do a tiered sort of launch like that is, I think it's really smart.
So if I go to Lego, I mean, I'm taking a shop.lego.com. What do I want? m.lego.com instead or something?
It's actually just negotiated on the server. So if you hit it on your iPhone, you would get the version that we built. Or if in Chrome, if you wanted to change your user agent string to iPhone, you could get it that way too.
But wow.
Yeah. But yeah, they're doing the old user agent detection, either serve it to a phone or don't kind of approach for now. So yeah.
Yeah, you keep saying for now. I think we all know, because they're eating non-kosher meat for now. They're going to be eating kosher meat soon, but right now it's not kosher. But you know, they're starting to wear the yarmulke. They're transitioning. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
They're not really.
Get into it.
Yeah. No. Yeah. That's fine. Because it's such a non-responsive, obviously non-responsive site. Otherwise, Lego Friends. That's the one girl thing they made. Like you don't have kids. You do have kids. You have a baby.
I do. I have a daughter. Yeah.
You have a baby daughter. Mm-hmm. She's like two now, three.
Actually, very young, like almost 8 months.
Okay, good. Time isn't rushing by as quickly as I thought. 8 months. No. That's great. So when she gets into Legos, what she will find, if they don't change, is that there's like a whole TV action series around ninjas that's all boys with like one ninja girl. There's Lego Friends, the show they made for girls, of which there is one episode. And the Lego Friends are like petting birds and dogs and holding baby deer, and you know, they all learn to pitch in. You know, at first they're jealous of how cute each other are and they're insecure, but they learn to pitch in and work as a team to put on a show to raise money for puppies in a charity. As opposed to the thousands of hours of boy entertainment that Lego has created.
Right. Yeah, that is, it's unfortunate.
It's unfortunate.
There was a good, there was a classic Lego ad that was, I retweeted it.
Like I saw that.
Ago. Yeah.
How they used to sell to girls.
Yeah. It would be nice to see that come back. I don't know. We just, we have a huge box of Legos that, you know, you just build it yourself. And she gets old enough that she's not going to choke on them.
Yeah.
Then they're all hers.
Everybody loves Legos.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's a holdover. And they're not American. Where are they? Are they in Scandinavia?
Finland, I believe.
Finland
is the headquarters. Connecticut in the U.S.
I think there's more, it's possible that there's more legal equality between the sexes in Finland and has been for a long time. Women have more rights, but that they're more traditional in gender roles. Than we are, so that you could have a society that was not sexist in one way and then kind of sexist the other way. And that's how you would get, So that's, how you would get something.
Unfortunately, it seems like they just sort of followed the same marketing angle that a lot of US companies did. I'm sure it worked well for them.
hopefully
we'll see a change there.
But all the kids are going to Minecraft now. They got to get in there. They've got to make Lego skins for Minecraft or something, if they're not already, which they probably are, because
it sounds familiar.
I loved when my daughter was into Legos, but I love Minecraft because I don't step on digital images at 2 in the morning.
Walking in the dark.
In the dark. It's much better. I just never step on it. Yeah.
So that's what I have to look forward to. Nice.
You do. It's going to be super cool. What's her name?
Emery.
Emery.
E-M-O-R-Y. Mm-hmm.
She, don't take this the wrong way, but you're a very handsome fellow. Your wife is gorgeous. She must be a very beautiful child.
She's, thank you. But yeah, she's a cutie. Yeah.
Oh, God. I just realized, what if she wasn't? What if there was some strange tragedy and she was a, never mind.
She's very cute.
My mind has been in dark places lately. Okay. What are you writing these days?
Yeah. So the book that I'm writing for, A Book Apart, Responsible Responsive Design.
Have we announced that yet?
Oh, yeah. It's all over the website.
Oh, okay. Then cool. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Okay. In that case, please continue, sir.
Yeah, it's in the late stages of writing at this point. I'm feeling great about it. And I think it's going into kind of final manuscript edits and copy edit stages. And it's pretty awesome. I think totally psyched.
I think all responsive design wants to be responsible. Sorry. Putting that specific focus on it is great. Tell folks basically what they can expect to see or what you mean by it. So what kinds of issues you're tackling.
Yeah, well, I think, Ethan's book, Responsive Design, addressed all, it basically solved the problem of adapting layouts across screen sizes, right? And this book sort of steps in to say, now that we have that, we need to combine it with other best practices to fully deliver on a responsible approach. So a lot of that has to do with performance, usability across different devices that have different input modes, touch, mouse, different sensors, things like that. So all these new factors we need to care about. And then it factors in accessibility as well. So being able to use these sites in a non-visual manner. So all of these different angles are sort of coming in to combine with the responsive approach to layout. And there's a pretty heavy focus on performance as well. The last two chapters out of six, I think, are just focused on delivering responsibly. So over the network kind of concerns.
Why do you think as an industry we tend to overlook performance and bandwidth? We tend to reward sites and applaud and give awards to work that's got like 10 megabytes of images or, you know what I mean? That all you have to be is at a hotel using Wi-Fi at a hotel and realize, wow, this site, I really loved this site in my office, but man, I do not like this site at all on this bus. Yeah. Why do you think we ignore all that so much?
I think it's, we're as web designers, I think we're kind of an exceptional bunch. We need, our work requires that we have access to the fast connections and the fastest and newest devices. And I think it's very easy to design for ourselves a little too much and sort of forget that there's a much broader variable audience out there that's really our audience that we're building for. So, I don't know. I guess that's my answer because it happens to me all the time too. I'll open up some, gorgeous, heavily photographic layout on my big screen and not really realize that same code is going to get shipped to an iPhone over a 3G connection.
You may notice it at home when Comcast or Time Warner Cable or whoever is suddenly having a minor problem. Latency is a huge thing, right? You might have 100 megabits down, but a latency of a second, or it seems like. And so, when you finally get stuff, it's great, but.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's not only about speed too, because now that we're seeing data plans that are, they seem to be more and more limited every month and more expensive and shared across devices. Like it's very common to have these, you buy like a bucket of data that you can use across all your devices on a cell network.
At the same time, you're using streaming media all the time.
Right.
People are doing that instead of cable, and it's the cable company that's providing the bandwidth. So, you'd think they would just charge a premium for bandwidth and be done with it, be happy.
Sure wish. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, to circle back, I think, you know, that's sort of the angle we've been taking with, you know, picture fill, things like that, is the more we move these things natively into the browser, the more we can let the browser say to make the final call, which is really interesting because we can say, here are a bunch of potential image sources. Some of them are, you know, more high quality than others, and they might apply to this device, but say the device knows better and the connection speed is slow, or that particular user's data plan is close to empty, they could say, you know what, I'm just going to load the crappy image and, you know, allow the user to choose if they want to upgrade it or not and their preferences or something like that. So I think that's, you know, that's a really neat aspect of getting these things built into the browser and offloading it to the browser that knows more than we do as authors. So
the way we used to offload fonts to the browser or to the mm-hmm. operating system and not worry about, you know, how yeah. many how many weights of Geneva or Georgia or whatever we were using.
Right.
Do you think we'll ever have a good proxy for touch? Do you think we'll ever be able to tell if a device supports touch or not? Because right now, there's nothing reliable. Screen size is kind of the best we have, and that's not reliable.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, screen size is not a good
because of all those Microsoft laptops that have touch screens.
Sure,
every
Chromebook.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
yeah, the Chromebook has touch. I mean, touch is not the domain of small screens anymore.
Not the exclusive domain.
If it ever was, but also when touch is supported, it's often one of many input devices that are available to the user. You know, sometimes there's a keyboard. Often there's mouse events that are fired as well. Even, you know, when you touch the screen on your iPhone, touch events and mouse events are fired. I would say my answer is we absolutely use touch events. We design as if they're going to be there and make sure it works if they're not.
If they're not.
Yeah. But if they are there, we can make things a little faster.
Especially if you're doing a somewhat complex responsive design where you want to bring things off-screen elements in mm-hmm. and use touch, or you want to have, do you know what I mean? You're like, well, if there's hover, then I'll use hover to do that. But if there's, you know, if there's...
Right.
I think one of the biggest challenges that responsive isn't just about screen size.
Mm-hmm.
Especially
about input mechanisms and
it's everything. Right. It's everything.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, on the detection side of things, we do have some features coming to CSS in the media queries level 4 spec that'll start to address these things, like the ability to detect pointer size, I guess. So you could say, how finite is the pointing mechanism on the device? Is it a mouse? Is it touch?
You can also detect hover. A tiny baby finger.
Right. Yeah. So, so those things are coming, but, you know, we would only be able to use those in very cutting edge environments anyway. So, I think the answer there is design as if, touch is going to be there. And if it's not, make sure it still works. Yeah.
Are you doing any design between devices?
Between devices.
So what do you mean exactly? One device controlling another.
Oh, that's interesting. I'll be honest, I haven't really done a whole lot of work in that area, but I think it's interesting.
I know Josh Clark, Dan Mall, Brad mm-hmm. Frost... starting to do stuff with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The only thing I can really think of is when we built a slide deck in HTML and set it up so the style sheet could work with a projector, you know, just media type projection.
Oh, nice.
And use the iPhone to control the screen like a remote. But... I mean, that's pretty lo-fi, I guess.
How do you worry that you will cease to be a cutting-edge technologist in the next 5 or 10 years, that you'll move into more, that other people are coming up right behind you who are going to kick your ass the way you've kicked ass.
You know, sorry, you dropped just a little bit.
Oh, okay. So
I got, do you worry?
Well, one of the things that happens when someone's really great at design or technology is they get to a certain level of acclaim, and then somebody coming along into the career that's new just blows them out of the water, kicks their ass, and they do you worry about that? Do you worry about not wanting to keep up with the technology 10 years from now?
I don't want to sound like a hippie, but I feel like the collaborative aspects of working on GitHub and things like that, it seems like everything is very transparent, and we're all kind of working together on whatever's coming.
Great answer. Fair enough. Thank you for your time today. It's been really nice.
Thanks for having me on.
It's been a pleasure. So people can find you at scottgel.com.
You are on Twitter.
Yeah, you're Scott Gel on GitHub, Scott Gel on Twitter.
Pretty much everything.
Yeah.
I don't think there's another one of those in the world. It's a weird name. So I'm lucky in that regard.
You're luckier than Tim Brown, for instance.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Have a great day. Right. Thanks.
Yeah, you too, Jeffrey. Thank you.
Bye-bye.